Hello, everyone. I'm bringing you today another special bonus episode, an interview with Dr. Craig Etchison. Craig is currently a visiting scientist at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. He was a founder of the Documentation Center of Cambodia and has been studying the Khmer Rouge regime for more than 30 years. He was also an investigator of the prosecution between 2006 and 2012, and also testified at the Khmer Rouge Tribunal as an expert witness. He recently published a book titled Extraordinary Justice, Law, Politics, and the Khmer Rouge Tribunals, adding to the previous publications The Rise and Demise of Democratic Kampuchea from 1984, and After the Killing Fields, Lessons from the Cambodian Genocide, 2005. Craig was one of the leading academics who sought to bring the Khmer Rouge to justice, and in this interview we touch on his early experiences doing just that, as well as his time with the tribunal. He is one of the most qualified people to talk about the goings-on of the 20 or so years that the Khmer Rouge Tribunal has been in some ways active. And here we get into some of the complexities involved in this experiment, as he puts it, including the shortcomings of the tribunal, government interference, as well as the status of cases still being heard. I had a great time talking to him. It was done over Skype, and we had a pretty good time difference to deal with between Melbourne and Boston, but he was a great guest. Being that it was recorded via Skype, naturally the audio leaves a little to be desired, and there are some minor dropouts here and there, but I think it will all come across. Now, this conversation, similar to the previous interview episode with David Chandler, does involve a certain familiarity with the subject matter, so there may be more value here for those more familiar, but I think either way it's an illuminating chat, and I can highly recommend his recent book for a proper history of the Khmer Rouge Tribunal. So, with that said, I give you Dr. Craig Etchison.
A kind of legal warning saying that I should tell you that you're being recorded, so you're...
Oh yeah, there it is.
Warned that you are now recorded, Craig. But let's dive on in, shall we?
Go for it.
All right, brilliant. Well, I will have given everyone a bit of a rundown of you and your career in the intro to the show. But I would like to start, if we can, with literally the first sentence of your book, which sounds a little bit amateur, but it's an interesting sentence to me, and it's somehow, somewhere along the line, Cambodia took over my life. And I think that's something that a lot of people, myself included, can relate with. I was wondering if you want to jump off, can you expand on that slightly? When did you first travel to Cambodia? What was that like? And how did you end up going from historian into someone whose central goal was helping to bring the leadership of the Khmer Rouge to justice?
Well, I would start by saying that I'm often identified in the media as a historian, probably because of the types of books I've written over the decades. But I'm afraid that might annoy some of my colleagues who actually are historians. My professional training was in political science, psychology, economics, and ultimately international relations. So I'm more of a political science type, really, than a historian. But from a very early age, I was always interested in large-scale, organized violence. What most people would call wars, but actually I think covers a rather broader scope of organized social violence. In fact, the very first paper I ever wrote was in the sixth grade about the Battle of the Bismarck in 1941, the sinking of the huge dreadnought, the feared German battleship. Of course, growing up during the Vietnam War and at one point being subject to the draft myself, war continued to be sort of an ever-present preoccupation with me as I went on to college. And finally, in graduate school, I took a course on revolution in the Third World. And one of the assignments for that course was to choose a Third World revolution and write a term paper on it. Well, my brother had fought in Cambodia, and I had followed what was going on there with some interest. So I chose that revolution to write my term paper on. And it ended up being a rather long term paper, 125, 130 pages. And when my professor saw it, he said, well, you know, there really aren't any good academic treatments of the Khmer Rouge Revolution in the literature. You should publish this as a book. Well, that wasn't the topic of my doctoral dissertation, but I went ahead and worked on that for a bit longer, and sure enough, that became my first book, The Rise and Demise of Democratic Kampuchea. Then I went on about finishing my doctoral work and began looking for an academic slot, a tenure-track university position. And while I was teaching at my alma mater, the University of Southern California, for several years, I was unable to secure the kind of position I was looking for. And so finally, at some point, I decided, well, this approach clearly isn't working. So I think I'll move to Washington, D.C. I had been very interested in theory throughout my graduate career. And I decided I'd go to Washington, D.C. and try and immerse myself in policy to get a better feel for how policy processes actually worked in the real world. Well, it turned out not to be much easier to get a job in Washington, D.C. until finally there was this tiny advocacy organization called the Campaign to Oppose the Return of the Khmer Rouge, which had been founded with the goal of attempting to exclude the Khmer Rouge from the quadripartite peace settlement that was being negotiated by, all of the great powers and the regional powers in Southeast Asia. And when the Paris Peace Accords were finally signed, with the Khmer Rouge included, well, the raison d'etre of that organization was suddenly exploded, and the little organization went into crisis. That's when I came along, and I said, okay, well, look, if the Khmer Rouge are now going to be part of a liberal, democratic, legitimate regime that's based on the rule of law, I can think of a number of laws that need to be enforced straight away. So why don't we reorient this organization to that end and press on? And so they hired me as the executive director. And at the beginning, I actually thought this was going to be a part-time, probably a relatively short-term job. But soon enough, I became utterly consumed with this work, and we managed to get sanctions passed in the U.S. Congress against Thailand for their continued support of the Khmer Rouge, which did indeed lead to them dramatically cutting back their backing of the Khmer Rouge, and ultimately the passage of a piece of legislation called the Cambodian Genocide Justice Act, which made it the formal policy of the United States to support the establishment of an international criminal tribunal for the Khmer Rouge. By this time I was all in, and I suppose you could say I didn't find my life's work. It found me, and I transitioned to become essentially a genocide investigator. Back in those days, there's no place you could go to school to learn how to do that. So I kind of made it up as I went along, learned from and talked to the few other people in the world who were doing this kind of thing, especially Sharif Bassayouni, who was leading the establishment of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. One of the key aspects of the Cambodian Genocide Justice Act was to support a project to collect information about what had happened under the Khmer Rouge and to establish a research center in Cambodia to study that. So this is what I focused on. And while at the same time lobbying countries and capitals around the world to get on board with the idea of establishing an international criminal tribunal. This was before the establishment of the Yugoslavia tribunal, or in later stages, right as it was coming into being. So there was really no precedent for this since the Nuremberg tribunals and the immediate aftermath of World War II. It was all kind of terra incognito. My mother, bless her heart, she went to her grave convinced that I must really be a CIA agent, but I just couldn't tell her because that was the only logical explanation she could come up with as to why I was, you know, flying to Australia and Asia and Europe and testifying before Congress and the Parliament in London and negotiating with the diplomats and spies and warlords all over the world. But it actually was rather remarkable to be doing this as a private citizen.
And this is before the establishment of the tribunal? This is still in the late 90s? Or are we talking now in the early 2000s as well?
No, we're talking the mid-90s here.
Mid-90s.
Okay. Yeah, mid to cause the establishment of the tribunal. Which turned out to be a very complicated political game.
So in this time, you're getting around Cambodia and the world. Is this also around the time where the remnants of the Khmer Rouge accuse you of genocide and sentence you to death? I believe you say it's by burning in the book.
Yes, that was in 1996. When we had established the Documentation Center of Cambodia in Phnom Penh and were in the process of scouring the country and the countryside, or at least those parts of it where our operatives could safely go. Well, the Khmer Rouge at that point in time still had a fairly robust organization, you know, with their own radio station. And they had very good diplomatic connections and a somewhat effective intelligence operation. So they knew exactly what we were up to. And unsurprisingly, they did not approve of what we were doing. They recognized us as a potential threat. Yes, one day on their radio station, they announced a people's tribunal and convicted me and two other colleagues of genocide against the Cambodian people and sentenced us to death, which they said would be by burning. Now, these are people who had already killed millions So we took that as a credible threat, but my attitude was, all right, we'll see if you kill me first or I put you in jail first.
Pretty good attitude. Well, speaking of that, I mean, if we fast forward slightly, I guess, I believe it's the 18th of May, correct me if I'm wrong, 2009, and you're sat in the trial chamber itself, a building designed and built to try the Khmer Rouge, and you are testifying as an expert witness in the case against Doik. Considering the effort and years and, as you just mentioned, danger involved in your focus on Cambodia, I can only assume this was a powerful moment. Can you describe that experience that morning? Do you have any reflections on the trial as a whole of case 01?
Well, of course, Doik, his given name was Keng Kek Uv. He was effectively the chief of the Khmer Rouge, top executioner. So he and he also reported directly the Standing Committee of the Communist Party Central Committee. Thus we viewed him as a key link in proving the crimes of the top leadership, particularly Nguyen Chea and Khieu Samphan, Ing Sary, and Ing Tirit, who were the others leaders charged initially in case 002. But Doik was case 001. And yes, indeed, it was a surreal experience for me to testify in his trial for well, for a variety of reasons. For one thing, my testimony was originally envisioned to last 2, perhaps 3 days, but it ended up stretching out over the course of about a month, in part because there was another witness who was time delimited, and so I needed to take a break since I was available all day, every day, indefinitely, to let that witness go. But for whatever reason, Doik's defense team really did not want me to testify, and they had seemingly hundreds of reasons why I should not be allowed to testify. And so the prosecution and the defense had to argue their way through all of those reasons. And that just took days and days and days while I sat there in the witness chair as, you know, they ping-ponged back and forth with arcane legal arguments. And sometimes rather absurd arguments, it seemed. But it was rather stressful because at any moment they could stop arguing these legal points between the prosecution and the defense and ask me some very detailed historical question. So I had to remain sort of on knife edge at all times and ready to respond if they slipped into the mode of interrogating me about something.
If I could just interject slightly there, Craig, I don't want to derail you, but I have to say, having recently watched your testimony again, you are by far the best witness I have heard in relation to speaking in a manner that allows the translators to translate and the judges to hear and respond. It seemed like, I'm not sure if you were conscious of that, but it's you, yeah, you stood out in that regard. For all of the trials that I've watched, you were the most calculated in how you spoke. It was very helpful, I think, in the court. But sorry, go on.
Oh, well, I was very careful about that. You know, I'd worked in Cambodia for a long time at that point, and was accustomed to working through translators. And in fact, we had several extremely competent linguists on our team in the prosecution office. So yes, I was conscious of working with the translators, and especially conscious of trying to make myself clear to both the national and the international judges, because, well, when you start diving down into the details, this is kind of complex stuff in many ways. But, well, one little anecdote that I thought was somewhat amusing was that, so here I was sitting in the courtroom in the witness table, in between the defense and the prosecution, and directly in front of the president of the trial chamber. Oh, maybe 20, 25 feet away, there was the defendant, Doik. He was regarding me very, very closely. And he kept trying to make eye contact with me. But, you know, I had three computers in front of me and many thick binders of reference material, because we were going to be covering a fantastic array of topics during my testimony, and I needed to be able to reference specific pages of evidence from the case file. So I needed all of these reference aids, and thus I had on my reading glasses. And with my reading glasses, I couldn't really clearly make out his eyeballs. And so I was unable to really make eye contact with him, although I could tell that he really wanted to do it. And as time went on, he became increasingly frustrated that I wouldn't make eye contact with him. That had some impact on his demeanor and affect during the course of my testimony, which, well, I thought that was kind of fun.
The highlight I took most recently was at some point, I believe it's both the prosecutors and defense realize that they have to read out something like 250 sources, or correct me if I'm wrong, it's something that will apparently take weeks simply to read out, and it's just this moment in the court where everyone has to sit down and say, oh, okay, we need to I think we need to fix this minor detail before we go on. It's there's many brilliant moments in it. I was
the structure of the trial was peculiar in many aspects, but one in particular is that Cambodia is a civil law system where the really the trial takes place before investigating judges, and they essentially make a determination as to guilt or innocence, and put all of their evidence and reasons in the case file. Then the case file goes to the judges, the trial judges, who read the case file and then either accept or reject the determination of the investigating judge. Well, in this case, the case file was really enormous, hundreds of thousands of pages. I think the trial judges decided they didn't want to read that much. And so they announced they would only accept into evidence, material that had been put before them in the courtroom live. This completely upended the prosecution trial plan because, well, you know, we wanted to introduce hundreds of thousands of pages of evidence and scores of witnesses. The trial judges severely circumscribed the number of witnesses they were willing to hear, and demanded that any documentary evidence we wanted to put forward, we had to present it, you know, page by page in court. And as you said, obviously, it would be a little bit impractical to present hundreds of thousands of pages, page by page. So yes, there was a lot of adaptation on the fly during that first trial. And well, indeed, one of the reasons for separating Doik from the other four in case 002 was that his case seemed relatively simple. It was largely based on documents Doik had created himself in his own little bureaucracy. So it seemed, and it was also largely about one single, albeit very large, prison in Phnom Penh. So it seemed like that would be a relatively modest and self-contained case to get through in court, and it would allow the court to essentially have a test run of all of the procedures in the rules of the court. That turned out to be a very good thing, because some of those rules turned out not to work very well in practice and required modification before we went on to the much, much larger and much more complex case 002.
Precisely. Yeah, it's always good to have a bit of trial and error, if you pardon the pun there. But Craig, if we fast forward again a few more years, well, essentially into the present, we're having this conversation today in a relatively short period of time after the death of Doik, and perhaps a year or so after the death of Nguyen Chea. The demise of these figures, the most recent in a steadily growing list of those Khmer Rouge that have died while awaiting trial or during it or after, it tends to beg a few questions from those that do take notice of these things. And it's the same questions that are generally asked. And two of them that I find come up all the time are, why did this take so long? And why were so few Khmer Rouge put on trial? Now, these questions are so common and that the ECCC website has included them on the frequently asked section of it. And in a sense, I'd say that the history of the tribunal that you've written goes a long way in answering those questions in a very compelling and thorough manner. So we'll point listeners there to get to the bottom of them. But I would like to explore just perhaps one section of that answer, the stumbling block that is represented by the Hun Sen government, who often emphasize the importance of national reconciliation as the reason why so few Khmer Rouge are going to be prosecuted. Could you explain why this idea of government interference is so often brought up in discussions of the extraordinary chambers of Cambodia?
Indeed, human rights advocates often allege that the Cambodian government was opposed to the trials. But from my perspective, it's a much more complicated picture than that. In fact, for many years, the Cambodian government did not just tolerate, but supported our work in trying to collect evidence in preparation for the trial. But at the same time, after 30 years of war and essentially two generations of young men being brought up and taught to do nothing but kill, in the wake of these wars, Cambodian society was really shattered and fragile and with a lot of dangerous people in it. So the problem of knitting back together the fabric of Cambodian society is really a complex, long-term, and generational struggle. So the government was very keen to try and ensure that these trials did not interfere with what they view with some reason as a matter of life and death in attempting to restore Cambodian society to some sort of a civil space where all of its citizens can live together in some level of peace and harmony. Because so many people in the current Cambodian government have their own Khmer Rouge history, the leaders of that government were very concerned that our investigations in the first instance and the trials ultimately not go too far and dig too deep. And so that was the reason why the negotiations took so long to establish the tribunal. They wanted to make sure they had veto power over certain issues in the course of the proceedings. And as it turned out, they also wanted veto power over exactly who could be prosecuted. And indeed, they did manage to engineer that.
I see. Well, I guess that neatly brings us to more recent developments here in cases 3 and 4 at the tribunal. And for someone like myself that has been trying to follow this these developments, I should say, I have to admit I had been confused about these for a couple of years now. I'd spoken to people when I was last in Cambodia asking about them, people at DC Cam, David Chandler himself saying there will be no more cases heard. And yet I kept seeing developments about new things happening. And it was only when I read your book, that I was able to see the long history there of cases 3 and 4. And it finally all came together for me why, in fact, it seems they definitely will not go ahead, according to these most latest developments. Now, these final cases illustrate a lot of the issues that the trials had, I feel. And I believe for someone like yourself who was working as an investigator, there's probably a lot for you to be able to say about what did happen there. I'm wondering if we can explore these cases a bit, why they won't go ahead, what other suspects had been on the table, so to speak, what are the kinds of things that were investigated but will eventually not see the light of day at the tribunal itself.
Well, the diplomatic agreement, largely unspoken, but actually sometimes articulated by people like Deputy Prime Minister Sok An or UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, was that the planning for the tribunal envisioned 5 to 10 prosecutions, 5 to 10 defendants. So we initially settled on going for about 10, but to decide who, we cast a fairly broad net and ended up doing fairly detailed investigations of about 30 different figures. Now, because we were working in an integrated office of nationals and internationals, and because the national leadership indeed were required to report up the chain to their political leaders, ultimately Hun Sen, the government was able to have a pretty good idea of exactly what we were doing all through our investigation, And our Western methods of investigation were entirely unfamiliar to our Cambodian colleagues. I think it's not too much of an exaggeration to say that how criminal justice in Cambodia usually works is they decide who they want to prosecute. Then they go and collect, or if necessary, manufacture the evidence, and case closed. Well, we turned that upside down, and we went out and looked at all of the evidence first before deciding on who. And in that process, we really looked at quite a few people. And this alarmed our Cambodian colleagues, and I think they thought that we were preparing to potentially charge dozens of people, which indeed would have breached the sort of unspoken diplomatic agreement that it should be no more than 10 people. Well, that was not our intent, but I think those concerns so spooked the political leadership that they decided 5 would be a fine number for the total number of people prosecuted. And that would be Doik, Nguyen Chea, Khieu Samphan, Ing Sary, and Ing Tirit. Well, we thought 10 would be a better number. So we went ahead and ultimately selected 6 other people to accuse. Just as we were preparing to finalize our introductory submission, however, we learned one of those 6 had died, so then it became 5, giving us, in fact, a total of 10. We put forward that submission initially in 2008. There was a challenge by the national co-prosecutor, so the case spent a year in the pretrial chamber before it was ultimately referred to the investigating judges in 2009. And since then, it's really been, well, you could say either a comedy of errors or a tragedy of justice. Those cases have been contested left and right between the nationals and the internationals all the way to the bitter end. One of the cases, one of the suspects has, in that intervening period, died. One of them, Im Cham, had her case dismissed by the co-investigating judges on the grounds that she was neither a senior leader nor a most responsible. The first international co-investigating judge, Marcel Lamonde, had said that if we found someone who was alleged to have killed 1,000 persons, well, we would absolutely have to prosecute that person. Well, Judge Lamonde was long gone by the time this came to the adjudication phase in the Office of Co-Investigating Judges, but his successor, Judge Michael Bolander, evidently took a very different view of that because he determined that Im Cham had killed many thousands of people, but still found that she did not meet the jurisdictional requirements to be prosecuted. So that was that in her case. The other 3 remaining suspects, Ao An, who was accused of genocide against the Cham Muslims, among many other crimes, Meas Mut, who was accused of genocide against the Vietnamese, among many other crimes, and Yim Tit, who was accused of genocide against both the Vietnamese and the Khmer Krom people. Their cases all became entangled in a dispute between the national co-investigating judge and the international co-investigating judge. The national judge wanted to dismiss all the cases. The international judge wanted them to go to trial and actually charge them with all of these offenses. And then those 3 cases essentially ended up in limbo in the pretrial chamber. Since then, one of those cases, Ao An, was appealed to the Supreme Chamber, where the Supreme Chamber declared that it was legally improper. In fact, I think they even called it illegal for the co-investigating judges to simultaneously issue a dismissal and an indictment. And so they effectively dismissed the case against Ao An. And so that one is finished. And my expectation is there will be a similar trajectory in the cases of Meas Mut and Yim Tit. And then, other than the final appeal of Khieu Sampan's genocide conviction, that will be the end of the story for the extraordinary chambers.
And how do you see that end of the story as well? How does the Khmer Rouge tribunal wind down? What happens to the resources gathered? What happens to what historians might find useful there?
Well, all through my involvement in this, really for decades, for me, in some sense, this was a gigantic experiment to see how far we could push this thing, how close we could get to justice. For many, many years, almost everybody told me that this was never going to happen. At best, I was wasting my time, and at worst, I was just going to get myself killed. But I wanted to see how close we could come to achieving some kind of justice for the crimes of the Khmer Rouge against the Cambodian people. And, well, it looks like we found out the limits of that process. But one of the really valuable things that will come out of it is the incredible historical record that we created. When we began our work in the Office of Co-Investigating Judges, in the Office of Co-Prosecutors in 2006, we really had the cooperation of all of the world's major historians of the Khmer Rouge. And most of them effectively gave their archives to us. So we had, just to begin with, an incredible amount of information about what happened under the Khmer Rouge regime. Then that led to what ended up being more than a dozen years of very intense on-the-ground, in-country investigation with many, many professional investigators, leading to thousands of interviews with Khmer Rouge cadres at all levels of the Khmer Rouge organization. And cumulatively, the amount of information about what happened under the Khmer Rouge that was assembled by the Office of Co-Prosecutors and the Office of Co-Investigating Judges is a multi-million page collection of historical information that is really unprecedented. The real question is, what's going to happen to all of that information once the court closes? Ideally, most, if not all of that, would eventually be made available to historians who could then go through it and really prepare much finer grained academic and historical works about the tragedy of the Khmer Rouge era than currently exist. But a lot of that is very sensitive. You know, for one thing, for example, people who we wanted to prosecute, but who the judges dismissed the cases against, well, they are technically innocent people. So there may be ethical questions about whether it's appropriate to release derogatory information about them. I would say, you know, if they're so innocent, they shouldn't worry about what other people say about them. But other people may have a different view of that. I'm not an ethicist, so it's not for me to say. But then there's the problem that those files also contain a great deal of information about many people in the current government. And some of that information may not align exactly with the official biographies of these politicians. So that's very sensitive as well. The bottom line here is it remains to be seen if those archives will ever be made available to historians to work with.
Craig, I'm becoming more and more conscious of your time here today. I'm wondering, would you have time for one more question?
Not a problem at all.
Craig, touching on that same issue, I guess, as someone who, I guess, at the start of this interview admitted that they would not rather call themselves a historian, still, what do you think are the biggest findings that came out of that? What do you think a historian, or for instance, if you were to rewrite that first edition that you contributed to the scholarly body, what would you be including that was previously unknown before the ECCC?
Oh my goodness. We have many orders of magnitude more depth and more detail about what happened under the Khmer Rouge than when I was initially writing that that first book now 30 years ago. We have recovered very large amounts of contemporaneous documentation created by the Khmer Rouge bureaucracies. We have interviewed, at this point, between the work of the court and the work of the Documentation Center of Cambodia, interviewed literally thousands of Khmer Rouge and thousands more of their victims. So the level of detail about what happened is just incomparable. That first book that I wrote would, it's just overtaken by events in terms of the scope of the information that's available now. One of the things that's been debated in scholarly circles about the Khmer Rouge for decades is whether or not the violence that they perpetrated qualifies legally as genocide under international law. With the scope of the information that has collectively been uncovered, I think that debate has been laid to rest. It wasn't just a genocide. It was a genocide against numerous different groups in Cambodia, the Cham Muslims, the ethnic Vietnamese Cambodian citizens, the Khmer Krom Cambodians, and in a very strong and well-written argument by one of the national judges, even genocide against the majority Khmer ethnic group. So I believe between all of the historical evidence that has been amassed and the judgments of the trial chamber, the debate over whether or not the Khmer Rouge committed genocide is finished.
There we go. Craig, thank you so much for your time this morning, this evening for myself. I'm very thankful for your answers today, Craig. It was a fantastic experience. Naturally, your most recent book, I believe, came out late last year. I'm going to direct people to that because it's the, if I would say so, history of the Khmer Rouge Tribunal that's been written, and it's extremely helpful for understanding just the complexity and weight of what has gone on there over the last 20 years or so. But yeah, your contribution there is extremely valuable, and I want to thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Craig.